They're gunning down the children of Jerusalem.
And that song was David Rovick's The Children of Jerusalem. Coming up next, we have the economic update with economist Richard Wolff. But before we go to that, let's hear this announcement.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, that's Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now we will go to economist Richard Wolff talking about General Motors.
Let us turn now to the larger issues that deserve our attention this week. Well, one of the biggest is General Motors, one of our biggest corporations, part of the history of the United States over the last nearly century as we've become an auto, truck, and vehicle dependent society. What can I say about General Motors? As the chief of General Motors famously said some years ago, how General Motors goes, so goes the nation. A little arrogant, say the least, but let's talk about it. General Motors really is an emblem, a symbol, typical of the United States in more ways than most Americans are prepared to admit. So what do we know about the General Motors Corporation over the recent past and back, say the last 10 years? The two biggest events of the last 10 years are the following. The most immense recall that any car company has ever had to do for systematically dumping onto the American people unsafe cars. Some of them are unsafe in ways that are frightening, but not life-threatening. But plenty of them are dangerous to the point that we now know, and General Motors has admitted, they kill people who drive General Motors cars. Just a couple of statistics about General Motors. So far in the year 2014, they have officially recalled 26 million vehicles. I kid you not, I'm going to say it again, 26 million vehicles. To give an idea of what this means, over the last 3 years, General Motors sold an average of 9.4 million automobiles a year. That means they've recalled pretty much the total cars, an amount of cars equal to their total production over the last 3 years. This allows me to say that General Motors produces an overwhelmingly unsafe product. But it's one we depend on. It is our largest automobile company. What does that mean? And what are we doing about it? The second big fact about General Motors in the last 10 years is that it went bankrupt. That's right, in 2008 and 2009, it went bankrupt. It had to be bailed out by the United States, which gave to the company over $50 billion. And when all the dust settled, the United States government, that is you and I, lost over $10 billion, the difference between what was given to the company that saved it and what it was able to reimburse one way or another. This company is, to make it simple for everyone to understand, a loser, a failure, a disaster that has cost the American people huge amounts of money, needless loss of life, injury, This is a company that has forfeited its right to be in charge of something we need as basic as cars and trucks. But we live in a system that not only bails out companies like this who go bankrupt, whose failure is that, but looks the other way when it says it needs to recall 26 million cars, a company that sells 9.4 million a year over the last 3 years. Any rational society, any society not befuddled and lost in a capitalist system that doesn't work anymore, would look at this situation and say, we need to reorganize General Motors. It can't be allowed to function the way it has. This is a broken business model, if I ever saw one. Bankrupt and dumping unsafe cars? Now the company announces it's going to spend billions to fix. To fix what? To what it hid for years? We've seen that's been proven. What it failed to catch? What it dumped on an unsuspecting and trusting public? To allow that company to continue is a commitment to capitalist enterprise, even at the expense of everybody else. It makes no sense. It is a dogmatic commitment to a system that doesn't work anymore. I could go on at great length about General Motors, but we have too many other things to look at today. But believe me, it is a sign of a society in real decline when it cannot see and take the necessary action in the face of a failure as enormous and multidimensional as General Motors. What a statement about corporate capitalism. What a statement about large corporations. But sadly, what a statement about the blindness and gullibility of a population that allows such things to continue. Didn't we learn from the failure of our biggest banks that plunged us into this crisis we're not out of? The crisis that began in 2007 and that is here with us 7 years later? Didn't we see what big corporations are capable of doing to all of us? Didn't we learn what it means if federal money is used to bail them out so that, in fact, they're bigger now than they were then? Threatening us with bigger failures than they did then? No, we didn't. So we allow a car company to begin to do pretty much what the finance companies did to us. A system that depends on these kinds of losing, social threatening enterprises to continue is one that doesn't want to look its own decline in the face and therefore limits its own abilities to change direction and solve its problems. The next major economic update for today has to do with yet another proof that we don't have an economic recovery. I know that the language of the press is full of recovery. On the 3rd of July, 2014, when the latest unemployment statistics were released, and it showed that our unemployment rate is down to 6.1%. The language was all about good news and uptick. It's really interesting. If you look at a select group of statistics, we look great. Stock market has recovered. Unemployment is down, things like that. But if you look at a different set of statistics, which any reasonable person and any trained economist would know, you see the opposite. And that therefore the picture is very muddy, and you have to explain. How could you have some numbers that look good, other numbers that look awful? How do you make sense of that? And an educated, reasonable, rational person has to do that. It would be silly to say those numbers don't exist that show falling unemployment and rising stock values. But it would be equally crazy not to look at the kind of numbers I'm about to give you and then to offer an explanation for them. Let me give you the explanation at the beginning. You'll see where we're going. The recovery is real for some people, mostly the top 1% to 5% of our people, corporate executives, small businesses that have come through, many haven't, and so on. Stock market has recovered. Big banks have recovered. But for the mass of people, no recovery at all. None at all. So how do you explain that? Well, the numbers the government likes to stress are the numbers that show what it wants to celebrate, a recovery. Let me give you an example with the unemployment numbers. Are we down to 6.1%? Yes. But the major reason we're down is a huge millions of people have left the labor force. They're not even looking for work anymore. And if you stop looking for work because you've given up, because you've gotten into trouble and you're in jail, if you have gone back into the household to become a household worker, male or female, for lots of reasons, you leave the labor force. In my mind, you're unemployed. In the government's counting, you're not unemployed anymore. You're not looking, therefore you're not unemployed. Okay, that's a number, but you have to know that. If you know that, then the falling unemployment rate isn't measuring good news that people are working again. It's actually measuring bad news that millions have given up. But here's what I want to stress today. A very good research foundation called the Russell Sage, S-A-G-E, Russell Sage Foundation, released a report in June of this year, June 2014, and it's about wealth levels in the United States. What they looked at was what happened to the wealth of American households. By wealth, they mean their bank accounts, if they own their own home, that. Any wealth that they have, the government keeps track and studies the wealth of the United States. And I found the results absolutely remarkable. First, let me give you the most stark reality. The wealth of American households between 2009, that's when we were supposed to have been through the worst of the 2007-2008 crisis. From 2009 to the present, Obama and others have wanted to call a recovery. The word recovery means you come back. What happened to the wealth of the American households between 2009 and 2013, the last year for which Russell Sage had data? Okay? Across every part of the American population, the wealth of households fell between 2009 and 13. Right? For the average American household, its wealth fell 27%. That's catastrophic. More than a quarter of the wealth of the average American household fell away, disappeared between 2009 and 2013. That's not a statistic that teaches recovery. That's a statistic that says things are awful and getting worse. Median, that's the household, 50% of whose wealth got worse, 50% of whose wealth did better. That fell 28%. Even for the top 10% of Americans, between 2009 and 2013, their household wealth fell 18%. Even the top 5%, as always, did better than everybody else. Their wealth only fell 12%. They did much better than everybody else. But everybody else, and them too, the wealth fell. Everybody lost. In fact, if you compare 2013 with a good year, 2003, before this crisis hit, you will see that for most Americans, the vast majority, they had less wealth in 2013 than they did back in 2003. That's adjusted for prices and all that. Let me say that again. Over the last decade, the vast majority of Americans, before and during the crisis, have lost wealth. They are poorer, to use simple English. Much poorer. What kind of recovery is this? No recovery at all. Let me turn now to another major issue. This one has to do with a report called Offshore Shell Games, produced by Citizens for Tax Justice and PIRG, P-I-R-G, Public Interest Research Group. And you can find it if you look. It studied the Fortune 500 corporations. That's basically the biggest 500 corporations in the United States. And it wanted to ask the question, do a significant number of them maintain subsidiaries in other countries whose main purpose is to avoid taxes here in the United States? In other words, do they keep their wealth in another part of the world, in these particular areas? And by the way, the two most famous and most widely used are Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. places where you do not have a subsidiary because you do significant business there. These are tiny places with very little population and nothing in the way of industry other than a little bit of tourism. Well, their discoveries are a real lesson for us. So let me give you the basics. Out of the Fortune 500, 362 of the companies use subsidiaries in tax havens in 2013. That's 72% of the Fortune 500 companies use tax havens. How many subsidiaries have they established in places like Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, Ireland, and other places where they can pay low taxes? They've established, get ready, this is wonderful, the 362 companies have established 7,827 subsidiaries. They are really making use of it. The 30 companies with most of the officially known tax haven subsidiaries, the 30 companies alone operated over 1,000 of them, more than 40 each. Wow. The top 30 companies of the Fortune 500, how much have they got stored away in these subsidiaries? $1.2 trillion. These numbers are staggering. Only 55 of the Fortune 500 released reports indicating what they saved in U.S. taxes by keeping their money in these phony subsidiaries. I say phony because of what their meaning is. They're legal to do all this, of course. Of course. Would these companies do something illegal? 55 of the Fortune 500 companies declared what they saved in U.S. taxes. It amounted to a total of $147.5 billion. Next time you hear that the government cannot afford to help potato farmers in Maine, to make sure children get vaccines, to make sure children get healthy diets, to take care of our needs as a people, please remember the $147.5 billion that simply 55 companies saved, when we know 362 companies are doing it. And I thought you might want to know the names of some of the biggest users of offshore tax havens. Ready? Here we go. Apple, Pfizer Drug Company. Isn't that interesting? Pfizer is one of those that I mentioned at the beginning of the program involved in jacking up vaccine prices. Here's some more names. Pepsi-Cola, Bank of America, Nike, American Express, Citigroup, Google, and Microsoft. Yes, yes. Champions of American industry. Captains of American industry. 100 years ago, companies like this, caught doing these sorts of things, were called robber barons. But we've come a long way, and with enough PR, a robber baron becomes a captain of industry. But what this system means is that they still do now, whatever their name, the same they always did. And let's remember, when large corporations can use tax havens abroad, tax havens that Citizens for Tax Justice can document, show, prove, whether all the information you need is there. They can keep getting away with it. The government does nothing about it. Well, the $147 billion that simply these 55 companies didn't pay, what does that mean the federal government has to do? It either, with that money it's not getting, it either has to tax the rest of us more, or if it doesn't, with that money it's not getting from these companies, that's $147 billion less that it can provide in the way of services and supports to the American people. Thank you is all we should be saying to these large companies, don't you think? Okay, in the time that remains, let me comment on some questions many of you sent in. Many of you have sent me questions about the Supreme Court decisions this last week. There were several of them. I'm going to comment on two. First was the decision in the case Harris versus Quinn. And basically here what was decided was that home health care workers in the state of Illinois who are paid by the government to take care of people, often their own relatives in the home, as a cost-effective way of providing care, are not considered, the Supreme Court decided, really government workers the way other government workers are. And because they aren't government workers the way others are, like someone who's a teacher or a firefighter or a police person and so on, they're not covered by a law passed back, a Supreme Court case, excuse me, passed back in 1977 called Abood, for those of you that are interested. And that case said if you're a public employee and you get the benefits that a union wins for the public employees, then you have to make payments to that union. They're not union dues because you're not a member and you're free not to be a member, but you have to pay a portion of the union dues because you're paying for all the services of the union involved in delivering to you the benefits the union won in its contract with the employer. This goes back to 1947 and the Taft-Hartley Act. It's part of American law that if you work in a place where a union gets higher wages and benefits, you are entitled to those even if you're not a member of the union. And when unions accepted that, the compromise that was reached was, okay, if a person doesn't want to be a member of the union, doesn't want to listen to what the union recommends, maybe doesn't even want to participate in what the union suggests, whether that be, you know, job actions or strikes, but if that person works there, they're entitled to all the benefits the union gets, there's something wrong here. And the compromise was the worker would be free not to join the union, but would have to make a payment to the union for all the benefits that the union won, and which must be given to all workers, whether they're in the union or not. And this is what these workers, these home health care workers, wanted. The Supreme Court didn't give it to them. And I thought the remark by Justice Alito was remarkable. Here's what he said. You cannot compel anyone in America to support the speech of a third person that he or she does not want to support. And see, the idea here was you can't make these home health care workers pay for what unions do just because they get the benefits the unions win. And I thought, my goodness, the narrow-mindedness, the ignorance of a Supreme Court judge. It's in America, you can't compel someone to pay and support the speech of someone that they don't agree with, because there were workers in Illinois who didn't want to give money to the union. Here's the thought. In America, we know we have many, many millions of people who are not members of any religious congregation. Some of them are atheists, others of them don't believe in religious institutions. They are spiritual or religious in their own personal life. What do we do in the United States? We compel them, Justice Alito, we compel them to pay taxes. And what are the taxes used for? To provide public services to every church, synagogue, or mosque in America. The police help those institutions. The fire departments help those institutions. The air and the water are cleaned for those institutions. On and on and on. They get a vast array of public services that they don't pay for. And you know who pays for them? All the rest of us. We are compelled to pay to support speech and other activities we don't believe in. Second decision had to do with a Hobby Lobby. This one was truly stunning. The court decided that a small business, the Hobby Lobby, could decide that when it didn't want to pay for medical coverage for its workers that it didn't believe in based on religion, that it wouldn't have to. It had to do with contraception and other kinds of medical support for its employees. The company didn't want to pay for those and said it violated their religious freedom that they have to pay for something they don't believe in. Well, what can you say? Let's remember something and let's be economically sophisticated just for a moment. The workers at Hobby Lobby and everywhere else, they help to produce the goods and services that Hobby Lobby sells. That's why you hired them. If Hobby Lobby earns a profit, all those workers participated in producing that profit. How is it then that in our economic system, all the people who help to produce something by their brains and their muscle are excluded from deciding how to use it? We allow the Hobby Lobby family that owns that company to alone decide what to do with the profits all its employees have helped to produce. How remarkable. And now the Supreme Court says if they don't want to support the medical coverage of their workers, by the way, medical coverage that their workers and they negotiated, medical coverage that is part of what you pay workers if you're a decent employer in this society. They want to decide who and what they will support. A tiny minority, the owners, want to decide the medical coverage they will pay for everybody out of the money, the profits, that everybody paid for and produced. My goodness, what kind of system would you do? Would you have? Yet the Supreme Court said, sure, we think it's only reasonable to allow the family that runs the company to decide what to do all by itself with the profits that all those workers produced. Even to decide not to make available the medical coverage that the law prescribes because they have a quote-unquote religious issue. And here, let me add, just because you can't satirize all of this, let me point out that a number of fundamentalist Christians have been attacking and criticizing Hobby Lobby in recent days. Why? They point out a monstrous hypocrisy that all over the shelves of Hobby Lobby, a place that has a lot of goods and services that are like toys and equipment for hobbies, that a huge portion of the produce that Hobby Lobby makes money off of is made in China. In China, where they support all kinds of activities, precisely those that Hobby Lobby wants us to believe are the reasons they can't cover their medical insurance for their workers. When it comes to making money off selling Chinese products, Hobby Lobby seems to suspend its deep religious commitments, doesn't it? Not my thought, the thought of a number of critics of Hobby Lobby who find its statement that it was driven by Christian commitments not too believable. But in any case, the bigger issue, why do we have a system that allows a tiny minority of the people involved in producing the profits in every enterprise to be in a position to decide how to use them? If we are Democrats, don't we want that to be a democratic decision? Wow. Wow. Well, I have many more. You've been sending me wonderful questions that I appreciate. But we have, once again, run out of time in our program. And therefore, I have to say so long for this edition of Economic Update. Chain, chain, chain. Chain, baby.
KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater proudly present Nightmares on Wax Live, playing at the Clinton Street Theater as a benefit for KBOO. Thursday, July 10th at 7 p.m. Performance comes from a sold-out show at The Refuge in Portland on Thanksgiving evening 2013. If you are one of the lucky ones who made it in, there's a good chance you are on the video. If you missed the show that night, this is a rare peek into a high-energy performance from DJ Ease and the Nightmares on Wax old band. That's Nightmares on Wax live, playing at the Clinton Street Theater, July 10th at 7 p.m. Go to kboo.fm for more information.
And this previous program, Economic Update, that was economist Richard Wolf. So do stay tuned now. Coming up is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it will be Flashpoints. The attorney for the Andy Lopez family responds to Santa Rosa's DA decision not to prosecute. A report from a doctor in the Gaza Strip after days of Israeli bombing, and a report on expanding Israeli vigilantism against Palestinians living inside the Green Line. And at 11, Glenn Andresen hosts The Dirtbag. He and guest Jim Gilbert discuss the bud graft method for building fruit trees. They also talk about when and how to pick fruits and veggies at their peak. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member of KBOO, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Oh, yeah, and you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. It's a half a minute before 10 a.m.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest is Steve Horn, back with us from the Dismarg blog to talk about Wisconsin, the latest petro state, and considering the question, is Oregon headed in that direction in the light of a recent alarming poll which indicates that citizens of Cascadia are a majority in favor of oil trains, also known as bomb trains, rolling through our neighborhoods, communities. And furthermore, that they know nothing about oil trains and have not read anything about oil trains. They haven't taken a look at this. Part of the problem here is the total lack of responsibility on the part of the mainstream media, which has not covered it, so there isn't very much for people to read, not much.